Section D. Citizens United also asks us to carve out an exception to Section 441B's expenditure ban for nonprofit corporate political speech funded overwhelmingly by individuals. As an alternative to reconsidering Austin, the government also seems to prefer this approach. This line of analysis, however, would be unavailing. In Federal Election Commission versus Massachusetts Citizens for Life, Inc., 1986, MCFL, the court found unconstitutional Section 441B's restrictions on corporate expenditures as applied to nonprofit corporations that were formed for the sole purpose of promoting political ideas, did not engage in business activities, and did not accept contributions from for-profit corporations or labor unions. BCRA's so-called Wellstone Amendment applied Section 441B's expenditure ban to all nonprofit corporations. McConnell then interpreted the Wellstone Amendment to retain the MCFL exemption to Section 441B's expenditure prohibition. Citizens United does not qualify for the MCFL exemption, however, since some funds used to make the movie were donations from for-profit corporations. The government suggests we could find BCRA's Wellstone Amendment unconstitutional, sever it from the statute, and hold that Citizens United speech is exempt from Section 441B's ban under BCRA's Snow-Jeffords Amendment, Section 441B(c)(2). The Snow-Jeffords Amendment operates as a backup provision that only takes effect if the Wellstone Amendment is invalidated. The Snow-Jeffords Amendment would exempt from Section 441B's expenditure ban the political speech of certain nonprofit corporations if the speech were funded exclusively by individual donors and the funds were maintained in a segregated account, Section 441B(c)(2). Citizens United would not qualify for the Snow-Jeffords exemption under its terms as written because Hillary was funded in part with donations from for-profit corporations. Consequently, to hold for Citizens United on this argument, the court would be required to revise the text of MCFL, sever BCRA's Wellstone Amendment, Section 441B(c)(6), and ignore the plain text of BCRA's Snow-Jeffords Amendment. If the court decided to create a de minimis exception to MCFL or the Snow-Jeffords Amendment, the result would be to allow for-profit corporate general treasury funds to be spent for independent expenditures that support candidates. There is no principled basis for doing this without rewriting Austin's holding that the government can restrict corporate independent expenditures for political speech. Though it is true that the court should construe statutes as necessary to avoid constitutional questions, the series of steps suggested would be difficult to take in view of the language of the statute. In addition to those difficulties, the government's suggestion is troubling for still another reason. The government does not say that it agrees with the interpretation it wants us to consider. Presumably, it would find textual difficulties in this approach, too. The government, like any party, can make arguments in the alternative, but it ought to say if there is merit to an alternative proposal instead of merely suggesting it. This is especially true in the context of the First Amendment. As the government stated, this case would require a remand to apply a de minimis standard. Applying this standard would thus require case-by-case determinations. But the archetypal political speech would be chilled in the meantime. First Amendment freedoms need breathing space to survive. We decline to adopt an interpretation that requires intricate case-by-case determinations to verify whether political speech is banned, especially if we are convinced that in the end, this corporation has a constitutional right to speak on this subject. Section E. As the foregoing analysis confirms, the court cannot resolve this case on a narrower ground without chilling political speech, speech that is central to the meaning and purpose of the First Amendment. It is not judicial restraint to accept an unsound, narrow argument just so the court can avoid another argument with broader implications. Indeed, a court would be remiss in performing its duties were it to accept an unsound principle merely to avoid the necessity of making a broader ruling. Here, the lack of a valid basis for an alternative ruling requires full consideration of the continuing effect of the speech suppression upheld in Austin. Citizens United stipulated to dismissing count 5 of its complaint, which raised a facial challenge to Section 441B, even though count 3 raised an as-applied challenge. The government argues that Citizens United waived its challenge to Austin by dismissing count five. We disagree. First, even if a party could somehow waive a facial challenge while preserving an as-applied challenge, that would not prevent the court from reconsidering Austin or addressing the facial validity of Section 441B in this case. Our practice permits review of an issue not pressed below so long as it has been passed upon. And here, the district court addressed Citizens United's facial challenge. In rejecting the claim, it noted that it would have to overrule McConnell for Citizens United to prevail on its facial challenge, and that only the Supreme Court may overrule its decisions. The district court did not provide much analysis regarding the facial challenge because it could not ignore the controlling Supreme Court decisions in Austin or McConnell. Even so, the district court did pass upon the issue. Furthermore, the district court's later opinion, which granted the FEC summary judgment, was based on the reasoning of its prior opinion, which included the discussion of the facial challenge. After the district court addressed the facial validity of the statute, Citizens United raised its challenge to Austin in this court. In these circumstances, it is necessary to consider Citizens United's challenge to Austin and the facial validity of Section 441B's expenditure ban. Second, throughout the litigation, Citizens United has asserted a claim that the FEC has violated its First Amendment right to free speech. All concede that this claim is properly before us. And once a federal claim is properly presented, a party can make any argument in support of that claim. Parties are not limited to the precise arguments they made below. Citizens United's argument that Austin should be overruled is not a new claim. Rather, it is at most a new argument to support what has been a consistent claim that the FEC did not accord Citizens United the rights it was obliged to provide by the First Amendment. Third, the distinction between facial and as-applied challenges is not so well defined that it has some automatic effect or that it must always control the pleadings and disposition in every case involving a constitutional challenge. The distinction is both instructive and necessary, for it goes to the breadth of the remedy employed by the court, not what must be pleaded in a complaint. The parties cannot enter into a stipulation that prevents the court from considering certain remedies if those remedies are necessary to resolve a claim that has been preserved. Citizens United has preserved its First Amendment challenge to Section 441B as applied to the facts of its case. And given all the circumstances, we cannot easily address that issue without assuming a premise, the permissibility of restricting corporate political speech, that is itself in doubt. As our request for supplemental briefing implied, Citizens United's claim implicates the validity of Austin, which in turn implicates the facial validity of Section 441B. When the statute now at issue came before the court in McConnell, both the majority and the dissenting opinions considered the question of its facial validity. The holding and validity of Austin were essential to the reasoning of the McConnell majority opinion, which upheld BCRA's extension of Section 441B. McConnell permitted federal felony punishment for speech by all corporations, including nonprofit ones, that speak on prohibited subjects shortly before federal elections. Four members of the McConnell court would have overruled Austin, including Chief Justice Rehnquist, who had joined the court's opinion in Austin but reconsidered that conclusion. That inquiry into the facial validity of the statute was facilitated by the extensive record, which was over 100,000 pages long, made in the three-judge district court. It is not the case, then, that the court today is premature in interpreting Section 441B on the basis of a factually bare-bones record. The McConnell majority reconsidered whether the statute was facially invalid. An as-applied challenge was brought in Wisconsin Right to Life, Inc. versus Federal Election Commission, 2006, and the court confirmed that the challenge could be maintained. Then, in WRTL, the controlling opinion of the court not only entertained an as-applied challenge, but also sustained it. Three justices noted that they would continue to maintain the position that the record in McConnell demonstrated the invalidity of the act on its face. The controlling opinion in WRTL, which refrained from holding the statute invalid except as applied to the facts then before the court, was a careful attempt to accept the essential elements of the court's opinion in McConnell while vindicating the First Amendment arguments made by the WRTL parties. As noted above, Citizens United's narrower arguments are not sustainable under a fair reading of the statute. In the exercise of its judicial responsibility, it is necessary, then, for the court to consider the facial validity of Section 441B. Any other course of decision would prolong the substantial, nationwide, chilling effect caused by Section 441B's prohibitions on corporate expenditures. Consideration of the facial validity of Section 441B is further supported by the following reasons. First is the uncertainty caused by the litigating position of the government. As discussed above, see Part 2D, Supra, the government suggests as an alternative argument that an as-applied challenge might have merit. This argument proceeds on the premise that the nonprofit corporation involved here may have received only de minimis donations from for-profit corporations, and that some nonprofit corporations may be exempted from the operation of the statute. The government also suggests that an as-applied challenge to Section 441B's ban on books may be successful, although it would defend Section 441B's ban as applied to almost every other form of media, including pamphlets. The government thus, by its own position, contributes to the uncertainty that Section 441B causes. When the government holds out the possibility of ruling for Citizens United on a narrow ground, yet refrains from adopting that position, the added uncertainty demonstrates the necessity to address the question of statutory validity. Second, substantial time would be required to bring clarity to the application of the statutory provision on these points in order to avoid any chilling effect caused by some improper interpretation. It is well known that the public begins to concentrate on elections only in the weeks immediately before they are held. There are short time frames in which speech can have influence. The need or relevance of the speech will often first be apparent at this stage in the campaign. The decision to speak is made in the heat of political campaigns when speakers react to messages conveyed by others. A speaker's ability to engage in political speech that could have a chance of persuading voters is stifled if the speaker must first commence a protracted lawsuit. By the time the lawsuit concludes, the election will be over and the litigants in most cases will have neither the incentive nor perhaps the resources to carry on, even if they could establish that the case is not moot, because the issue is capable of repetition, yet evading review. Here, Citizens United decided to litigate its case to the end. Today, Citizens United finally learns, 2 years after the fact, whether it could have spoken during the 2008 presidential primary, long after the opportunity to persuade primary voters has passed. Third is the primary importance of speech itself to the integrity of the election process. As additional rules are created for regulating political speech, any speech arguably within their reach is chilled. Campaign finance regulations now impose unique and complex rules on 71 distinct entities. These entities are subject to separate rules for 33 different types of political speech. The FEC has adopted 568 pages of regulations, 1,278 pages of explanations and justifications for those regulations, and 1,771 advisory opinions since 1975. In fact, after this court in WRTL adopted an objective appeal-to-vote test for determining whether a communication was the functional equivalent of express advocacy, the FEC adopted a two-part, 11-factor balancing test to implement WRTL's ruling. This regulatory scheme may not be a prior restraint on speech in the strict sense of that term, for prospective speakers are not compelled by law to seek an advisory opinion from the FEC before the speech takes place. As a practical matter, however, given the complexity of the regulations and the deference courts show to administrative determinations, a speaker who wants to avoid threats of criminal liability and the heavy costs of defending against FEC enforcement must ask a governmental agency for prior permission to speak. These onerous restrictions thus function as the equivalent of prior restraint by giving the FEC power analogous to licensing laws implemented in 16th and 17th century England, laws and governmental practices of the sort that the First Amendment was drawn to prohibit. Because the FEC's business is to censor, there inheres the danger that it may well be less responsive than a court, part of an independent branch of government, to the constitutionally protected interests in free expression. When the FEC issues advisory opinions that prohibit speech, Many persons, rather than undertake the considerable burden and sometimes risk of vindicating their rights through case-by-case litigation, will choose simply to abstain from protected speech, harming not only themselves but society as a whole, which is deprived of an uninhibited marketplace of ideas. Consequently, the censor's determination may, in practice, be final. This is precisely what WRTL sought to avoid. WRTL said that First Amendment standards must eschew the open-ended rough-and-tumble of factors which invites complex arguments in a trial court and a virtually inevitable appeal. Yet the FEC has created a regime that allows it to select what political speech is safe for public consumption by applying ambiguous tests. If parties want to avoid litigation and the possibility of civil and criminal penalties, they must either refrain from speaking or ask the FEC to issue an advisory opinion approving of the political speech in question. Government officials pore over each word of a text to see if in their judgment it accords with the 11-factor test they have promulgated. This is an unprecedented governmental intervention into the realm of speech. The ongoing chill upon speech that is beyond all doubt protected makes it necessary in this case to invoke the earlier precedents that a statute which chills speech can and must be invalidated where its facial validity has been demonstrated. For these reasons, we find it necessary to reconsider Austin.